The most commonly offered piece of advice to victims is to just leave. Have you ever stopped to think about why we offer this comment when we know that it's probably hurtful and most likely not useful? Thank you so much for joining me on Breaking Free from Narcissistic Abuse. I'm your host, Dr. Carrie Kerr McAvoy, a mental health specialist with over 20 years of counseling experience and a narcissistic abuse survivor. In this episode, we're going to examine the underlying biases and assumptions about abuse and abuse victims, why there's a cultural blindness when it comes to victims' plights, and how it leads us to neglect this most vulnerable population. I'm thrilled you're here with me today. Please remember to subscribe so you don't miss future episodes, and leave me a review and let me know what you think of the show. Finally, thank you so much for your donations to this listener-supported podcast, because together, we're shedding light on all things related to abuse. So with that, let's listen in to this replay of a TikTok Live. Found yourself in a relationship with somebody that's dangerous or predatory or narcissistic or psychopathic, and you found it terribly difficult to break free. Maybe you wore out your friendships. People got weary of hearing you talk about the same situation. Maybe you even got weary of yourself. You wondered what's wrong with you. I know I got to that place where I felt like I was the most pathetic person in the world. I didn't know why I couldn't leave. I didn't know what was going on with me. I was talking to someone just recently who was trapped in a relationship, been in this relationship for a long period of time. And they're very aware that it's abusive and that they probably should leave, but they're struggling to get out. So what I have noticed is this. There seems to be two groups of people, and I want to address this today about why there seems to be this big chasm, this big gap. There's the group of the victims who are in the relationship who can't seem to leave. And I want to talk about what's going on with them and their mindset and why that's the way that it is. But then there's the other group of people who may be the observers. Maybe they're the friends and families. Maybe they're the people on social media. But there is the second group who is, they're watching this drama play out and they're irritable. And they say things like, just leave. Or you obviously are a pretty sick person because you're not taking action to protect yourself. So you feel this frustration and judgment from the second group for the first group. So why are there two big categories of people? Why this two very divergent views of the same situation? I know me as a victim, it's very easy for me to think that if the people who say that found themselves in this situation, that they would find it no easier to get out of than I found it to be. But maybe they may never have that experience and they might not know what it feels like to be on the inside of the relationship. I thought it would be interesting to talk about the theories, why we have different perspectives of this, and I want to come at it from a couple of angles. The first is, I want to come from the standpoint of we know what we know and we only know that, and we use that viewpoint as a way to apply our understanding of the world. What I found as I was, by the way, I'm a psychologist with over 20 years of counseling experience, and when I was going through graduate school, they talked about how language, one of the first things an infant begins to learn is language, because that's the way we communicate. It's also the way that we decode the world. We put meaning to what we experience. So if you have something that hurts and a caretaker tells you or caregiver tells you, oh, that's pain, does your knee hurt? You learn, oh, that's my knee and the feeling I'm having is pain. You begin to completely make sense of your world. You taste something wonderful and they say, oh, it's sweet. Do you like that candy? They put words to your experience and that begins to be how you see the world. So for example, if you grew up in a part of the world where it doesn't snow and you for the first time see snow, you're going to think when you know the word snow, but you don't know anything else, you just know the word snow, you're going to say, oh, this is snow. This wet, it's cold, it melts on my skin, comes out of the sky, you're going to see snow. But if you grew up in the Arctic area, maybe you grew up in one of the kind of indigenous populations who have to cope with snow for great periods of time, they have various words for snow. I've heard there's upwards to 17 different ways to describe snow. Now, I grew up in Michigan. I don't have 17 words for snow, but I do know that there's dry snow, there's wet, slushy snow. I mean, I don't have 17 different words, but we certainly have ways that we described snow. So that to me, it's just not snow. We would say, oh, it's a real wet snow today. And I was like, oh, yeah, it means it's near thawing and it's going to be heavy. And if I have to go shovel, it's going to really hurt my back. But if it's cold and windy and it's like sub-zero, that's going to be a very dry snow and it's going to drift a lot. Then I know, oh, I better get home because it's going to start to drift and the roads are going to get bad. You learn the words that you grow up with, or the words that you hear when you're learning words, begin to define the world as you see it. So if you're in a world with lots of different types of snow and they use these words, you're going to see snow from that perspective. It's going to tell you information. If a word doesn't exist for you, it's literally not part of the lexicon of that language, then you're not going to be able to actually even know what that concept is. Now, here's a fascinating one that really blew my mind. I lived in Mexico for 2 years. I know some Spanish. I'm solamente más o menos, a little bit, un piquito. I'm not super good at it, but I know enough that I can maybe manage a little bit of getting around things there. So I was seeing a trained psychologist, actually, had a PhD, and who knew English, had a very good command of English. In fact, she trained in Canada, so her graduate training was in North America, and she was very, very solid in her understanding of English. So I said to her, because I was learning the Mexican way of saying how you felt, you know, if you're upset about, or you feel a lot of emotion, you say, muy emocionada, I'm very emotional, would be how you say I'm very excited. Or if you want to say to sell someone to relax or it's going to be okay, you'd say, tranquilo, it's going to be okay, calm down. So I was learning these words for how to describe kind of emotional context in Spanish. And I said to her, so what word in English does not exist in Spanish? Is there a word, an emotional word that does not exist in Spanish? And she thought about it and she said, yeah, I know of a word that doesn't exist in Spanish that exists in English. She says, accountability. What? She said, yeah, accountability doesn't exist. And somebody else that's a native speaker was there, and this person paused and thought and said, well, what about responsibility? That's the Spanish word. And she goes, yeah, but it's not really the same as accountability, because that has to do with integrity, a sense of like being accountable, held responsible for what you do to someone else, for other people. So it's not really capturing accountability, because there's more dynamics than just that. This person thought, he goes, you're right, that doesn't really capture it. And I've tested this. I've gone down and asked other bilingual people about that, and they're like blown away. They're like, you're right. There's no Spanish word for accountability. Now think about what that means. So if you're trying to set up an AA program and you want to build in a mentorship and you want mentors to help hold people who are struggling accountable, and there's not the word for accountability, you're going to have a hard time having them know how to really step in and operate that way for a person. So literally, they're not going to have the language to understand this concept any more than if I had some made up word for snow that meant this snow was like super dry, very sticky, and maybe even dangerous. And if I said that to you, you're like, I don't know what you're talking about. I have no concept of that. When we're talking about victims, and we're talking about what happens to victims' mentality, the inside experience of what it's like when we begin to go through abuse, some of us have grown up in situations in which we're very self-protective. I'm thinking of, for example, attachment theory. There's the perspective of some of us have a secure attachment, that we feel confident, we can go out and take risks, we can ask for what we need. We know people in our world's not going to go away or go anywhere on us. That's a secure attachment. Unfortunately, not a lot of us grew up with that, but hopefully we can learn to do that. But more likely, we're fitting into one of other two categories. There's actually three others, but a lot of us are anxious attachment. And in those individuals, relationships are risky. And we do a lot of work. We're used to kind of pleasing people and showing up and really going above and beyond in order to keep them happy, to keep them in our life, because we're used to abandonment. We're used to losing relationships. So when people kind of go quiet or disappear on us, we have to work harder. Or we're avoidant. We're used to people being too intense and showing up too much, taking away from our control. We feel overwhelmed by their agenda. We lose track of ourselves. So we tend to like push back, and we try to manage their intensity and keep them out of our lives. We're rather avoidant. We withdraw more. So when we have these different viewpoints and we have different boundaries, so an anxious attachment person's boundaries is going to be really fluid. They're going to put up with more. They're going to be more tolerant of things. They're going to probably do more work. Most of us would say a little bit of people pleasing. I think that's kind of unfair to apply that, but it may look that way. Whereas the avoidant person is going to be more rigid boundaries, and they're going to be less pursuing. They're going to put less energy into a relationship. They're going to disappear faster. So when you think again about abuse and language and the way we see things, if you're a person who sets boundaries really well and you don't have a problem with cutting people loose and you're very used to being on your own and independent, and you see someone who's struggling and who's captivated in this relationship and doesn't know how to get help, you're going to be blind to their situation and not be supportive. You're going to be critical of it and feel that they should see things the way that you see it without realizing that they don't have the worldview that you do. But if you're one of these individuals trapped in these relationships and you know your reality and you know what you've been living with that most people have no idea, and that's the thing that I found the most challenging about when I was in an abusive situation, is that the experience that I had was completely not imaginable. And I spent all of my adult life, because I got right in from 18, I started college and learning psychology. I worked all the way through to get my PhD by 28. And I started practicing and seeing clients at 28. I'd spent my entire life trying to make sense of human nature. And I'm now in a relationship as a 50-something year old. And it exceeds my experience, my understanding. In fact, I had a specialty in domestic violence. I worked with runaway teens when I was back, you know, a 20-something year old. I had all these experiences with working with this population without understanding what this population was going through, which for me, even saying that was, I'm humbled. I'll tell you, it's embarrassing. So here I am, I'm in an abusive relationship and I can't get out and I feel completely crazy. And I don't know what's going on, except that what I do know is going on feels very, very unsafe. And whatever I do is going to be a mistake. I can't get out well. There's no getting out well of this relationship. In fact, one reason you stay is because at least the devil you know is better than the devil you don't. So you know the rules of what it looks like to stay. But if you leave, man, this person's going to make it painful. They're going to really hurt you and hurt you good. So it's just easier to do nothing. It's just easy. But the rest of the world who's not experienced this has a blindness and they don't see that. They haven't experienced it. They don't know what it's like on the inside. And so as a result, their advice is often, at least it's ignorant advice. And at the worst, it augments, it worsens the abuse. We feel abused not only by the abuser, but we end up feeling abused by the public. When I was in the middle of the toxic marriage, I couldn't figure out if I should stay or go. I didn't know if he was a good person or not. Was there hope? Was he really getting help like he said? And my mind would just get stuck on these questions. It became like a paralysis, sort of a form of gridlock. And every option felt like the wrong option. Are you in a similar spot? Well, I've created a course, an online course and workbook just for this. I wrote it for the me that I was when I was stuck back in that last marriage. It's called First Steps to Leaving a Narcissist. It's been designed to help you break through the mental fog so that you can begin to see the truth clearly. It's going to take roughly 7 hours to work through and includes psychological questions and exercises, the type that you would get if you went and saw a counselor. There's videos and detailed explanations of what cognitive dissonance is. There's also a workbook that's both a companion to the course that will help take your experience to the next level, but it can also be used as a standalone guide, although I strongly urge you to do it in conjunction with the course. I have created both a digital copy so that you can keep your answers on your device so that it's kept private for your safety, But maybe you're someone who prefers to hold a book in your hand so you can also get the print copy through Amazon. If you find yourself trapped and you don't know what to do next, then this is for you. It is something that I needed so desperately a few years ago, and it would have saved me so much lost time and tears. So you want to learn more? See the link in the show notes to hear more about first steps to leaving a narcissist. The other problem going on that makes this super tricky is that for the victim, they're experiencing what's called cognitive dissonance. Now, what is that? And by the way, I have really made this a big study of mine because when I was going through it, I really wanted to understand why there was moments where I couldn't even speak. I literally was mute. I had selective mutism. I couldn't operate on my best interests. I had a PhD, guys. I used to take on clients in the office. It wasn't like I didn't know how to be able to sort of like handle difficult people. But why wasn't I able to handle this situation? Yes, I wanted this person's approval. And yes, I wanted their love. But there was something else going on that just was mind-boggling. What's interesting is that cognitive dissonance has been around for forever. And we're just now researching it. It's one of the hottest topics in sociology. We're trying to study and understand because what they're discovering is that chronic experience of cognitive dissonance causes brain damage. Yeah, you heard me correct. It causes brain damage. So what's happening to the victims when they begin to experience this chronically, their level of functioning begins to deteriorate. So your forgetfulness, disorganization, the way that you're struggling to find words, how vigilant you feel, your inability to sleep, that's all real. It's based on what's happening to your brain. And it's being changed. The experience is changing it. So what is cognitive dissonance? Let's back up and talk about it because it's something that happens to all of us all the time. You don't even notice it when it's happening. It's when you experience two opposing beliefs and you have to make a decision. So here's a good example. You are on a budget and you're coming to the end of the month and your account's getting low. So you know that you need to be careful because you need to make it the last few days and maybe you won't even have enough gas. So you want to save that last few dollars in order to get to the end of the month. But you spot a shirt or a blouse that you need and it's on sale, but it's going to eat up the rest of the money and you won't have the money you need for gas. And you don't know how long the sale is going to last. And you go and you talk to the salesman and they say it's the last one they have in stock of that size. So if you wait a week, you may not be able to get it for this price, and it may not even be available. So what do you do? That moment of that indecisiveness, that pain that you feel, that's cognitive dissonance. So you make a decision. And yes, some of you are already telling me what decision you'd make. You make a decision, and the minute you make the decision, you've solved the cognitive dissonance. You make some explanation to yourself. Either if you decide to buy it, you justify it some way. You say, well, I'll borrow some money from my friend and that'll tide me over the gas because I'll save money. But you say something to yourself that justifies why you decided what you decided. If you decided to wait, you tell yourself you'll find something else that will work. I mean, you say something. You make some solution that sort of gets you through it so that you can feel okay with about your decision. The problem that happens with abuse is the cognitive dissonance is about your partner or about the situation. In fact, there's three stages of it. In the beginning, you think you find out something shocking that you didn't know about this person, that like maybe, you know, they lied or there's something going on you had no idea. Now you're seeing a side of them you didn't know existed. You didn't know that you'd been love bombed. You thought you really met the right real person. And now you're discovering you don't know them the way you think you know them. And so the big first cognitive dissonant question you ask yourself is, who is this person? Are they good or bad? And who did I get into a relationship with? So there's where your first set of like big stopping moment. And you can't decide because they seem to be both. They go back and they treat you the way that you were when you first met them. And then they have another bad moment or another big blow up and you think you see the other side. So you see both sides and you're living in this waffling between both sides and you can't tell what's real. Or maybe that you did catch them on something bad And then they tell you, you know, with a really big tears that they're working so hard and they've never worked harder. You're the best thing they've ever found and, you know, all of this stuff. And you're caught because you think, well, what kind of person would I? Am I going to walk out on somebody? Well, I don't want to walk out on just somebody who needs me, who someone who's changing. And we just took a poll. Do you find it easy to leave a narcissist? And 80% of you said, I struggled immensely. Nobody said they didn't struggle. Nobody said this was an easy decision. It was a difficult decision for everybody. And us, 20% of you are still trying to leave right now. So that's fascinating. Thank you for sharing your information on that. I appreciate that. So you're waffling on that about who is this person? And then it doesn't get better. It keeps getting worse. So then the next stage of cognitive dissonance is you start to ask yourself, is this relationship worth saving? Is it salvageable? And you kind of waffle back and forth. You see moments of like give you hope. I know mine said he was going to therapy. My therapist thought it sounded like he was working. I was getting input. This looked like he was working. He said some of the right things. And then there would be another really bad thing. And then there would be another, you know, it was back and forth on this. So that's the second stage. And then the third stage of cognitive dissonance is you begin to think what's wrong with you. You're not making any decisions to take care of yourself. It feels utterly crazy making. This is not who you've been. This has not been your track record. You don't behave like this. And you're still here. And you wonder what's wrong with you. You can see the levels of cognitive dissonance are worsening. It's, I don't know who my partner is. I don't know what's going on or to my friend or my loved one is. Why am I still in a relationship with this person? I don't know why. Should I not? And then you begin to think, what's wrong with me because I'm still staying in a relationship with them? You can see how there's decline. But that chronic state of stress and indecisiveness, because remember, cognitive dissonance is just about a decision. It's about a momentary decision that we make, decide, move on. But when we stay in this, and I remember it was like the last thing on my mind when I went to bed. It was the first thing on my mind when I woke up. And I would watch all day long. I would watch for evidence of, do I lean this way or do I lean this way? Or I lean this way or I lean this way. And some of us stay there for years. And meanwhile, the stress of this is causing deterioration to our brain, causing loss. Back to where I started about why do people say to just leave? I think because they don't understand what we're going through. It's inconceivable. I think because they've not experienced this chronic cognitive dissonance, because they don't understand that we are now becoming damaged by the abuse. In fact, it's now being theorized, and I think this is fascinating. The big question has been, what's the worst kind of abuse? Even that question to me is stupid. It's kind of like an insulting question. We shouldn't be asking what kind of abuse is the worst abuse, because all abuse is inappropriate. But interestingly, we do ask that. And what they've been finding is the worst kind of abuse they're discovering is narcissistic abuse. Why? Because it erodes your sense of self. It chips away your confidence. It demolishes you as a person, and it damages your brain. It has incredible ramifications. I'm not saying it's okay to sexually offend somebody. I'm not saying it's okay to beat up somebody, that these things are better. Because like I said, I think even the question's a ridiculous question. But I want you to, but the bias has been because it's invisible, because it happens to the person's emotions and self, therefore it's less hurtful. The reality is it's not less hurtful. It is just as damaging, maybe even more damaging, because it's damaged something about our sense of self. I'll tell you now who I am today. I really like who I am. I'm confident. I'm doing things I never thought I would do. But the person that I was before I got into that relationship, she died. I could feel her dying. She doesn't exist anymore. My naivete, my innocent view of the world, my belief that everybody are basically well-meaning, my level of trust that I have, that got demolished. And will it come back? Well, it's different. It's come back, but it's different. So I'd love to know, now that you listened to this episode, what do you think as a victim? Have you been told just to leave? And did you find that advice helped you, or did it hurt you? Or maybe you're someone who knows a person who's trapped in a toxic relationship? Are you struggling to figure out how to help and encourage them? There's often a huge gap between those who are trapped in a toxic relationship and those who are watching. So what do you think would help close this gap? DM me on Instagram or email your thoughts. I know this is a challenging situation and that both sides often feel extremely helpless and overwhelmed. And thank you so much for joining me today. Have a great weekend, and I'll see you back on Monday.